and immediately became dizzy. From high up, it took him a long moment to realize that what he saw from here was the city. At first, he thought he was looking at a giant forest, the slender tree trunks stretching straight up toward the sky, each one sprouting perpendicular branches of varying lengths. The city's buildings were the leaves hanging off these branches. The layout of the city looked random, and different trees had different densities of leaves. The Hibernation and Reawakening Center formed a part of one of those large trees, and the leaf that contained his bed hung from the narrow platform that now extended out in front of him. Looking back, the tree trunk his branch was connected to extended so far upward that it disappeared out of view. The branch they were on was located in the middle to upper section of the tree, and above and below them he could see other branches, and the structural leaves that hung on them. On closer inspection, the branches formed an intricate network of bridges in space, bridges with one end left floating in midair.
"What is this place?" Luoji asked.
"Beijing."
He looked at the nurse, even prettier now in the morning sun. Looking back at the place she called Beijing, he asked,
"Where's the city center?"
"In that direction. We're outside the west fourth ring, in tree 179, branch 23, leaf 18. So you're almost able to see the entire city."
Luoji looked for a bit into the distance where she pointed, and then exclaimed,
"Impossible! How is there nothing left?"
"What would be left? In your day, there was absolutely nothing here."
"Nothing? The Imperial Palace? Jingshan Park? Tiananmen? The China World Trade Center? It hasn't even been 200 years. It can't all have been torn down."
"All those things are still there."
"Where?"
"On the surface."
Seeing Luoji's terrified look, she burst out laughing so hard that she had to lean on the railing for support.
"I forgot. I'm really sorry. I've forgotten so many times. Look, we're underground here, 1,000 meters beneath the surface. If I ever get to time travel to your time, you can get back at me and forget to tell me that the city's on the surface, and I'll be as terrified as you are now."
"But this..."
He held up his hands.
"The sky is fake. The sun is fake, too,"
the woman said, trying to suppress a smile.
"Of course, saying it's fake isn't right either, because it's an image taken from an altitude of 10,000 meters and displayed down here. So, maybe it counts as real, too."
"Why build the city below ground? And 1,000 meters? That's really deep."
"For the war, of course. Think about it. When the Doomsday Battle comes, won't the surface be an ocean of fire?" "Yeah, that battle is another outdated idea now. But when the Great Ravine ended, all the world's cities developed underground."
"So all the cities in the world are underground now?"
"The majority of them."
Luoji took stock of the world again. Now he understood that the trunks of the great trees were the pillars supporting the vault of the underground world, and also served as the columns from which the city's buildings were suspended.
"You won't be claustrophobic. Look at how broad the sky is. Up on the surface, the sky is not nearly this wonderful."
Luoji looked again at the blue sky, or rather the projection of the blue sky. He now noticed a few small objects, just some scattered bits at first, but once his eyes got used to looking, he saw that there were so many that they covered the entire sky. Strangely, the objects in the sky reminded him of some place completely unrelated, the showcase of a jewelry store. Before he became a wall facer, back when he had fallen in love with the Zhuang Yan of his imagination, he had once been so obsessed that he wanted to buy his imaginary angel a present. He went to the jewelry store and looked at all the platinum pendants in the showcase, every one of them exquisite, lying there on the black velvet and twinkling under the spotlights. If the black velvet had been blue, then it would have been just like the sky he saw today.
"Is that the space fleet?" he asked excitedly.
"No, the fleet isn't visible from here. It's beyond the asteroid belt. Those, well, they're everything. The ones with a visible shape are space cities, and the points of light are civilian spacecraft. But sometimes there are warships in orbit, too. Their engines are very bright, so you can't stare at them. Okay, I've got to get going. You should head back soon. It gets windy here."
Luoji turned around to say goodbye, but was so surprised he couldn't speak. The woman had her umbrella, or rather, her bicycle, positioned on her back like a backpack, and then it stood up in back of her and opened overhead to form two coaxial propellers that started up silently, turning in opposition to offset rotational torque. Then she lifted slowly up into the air and hopped over the railing beside her into the abyss that had so dazzled him. Suspended there, she called to him,
"You can see how this is a pretty decent age. Think of your past as a dream. See you tomorrow."
She flew gracefully, the small propellers churning the sunlight, until she turned into a tiny dragonfly between two giant trees in the distance. Swarms of these dragonflies flew between the giant trees of the city. More notable still were the streams of flying cars like schools of fish navigating endlessly among the plants on the ocean floor. The rising sun shone onto the city and was cut into shafts of light by the trees, coating the traffic with a layer of gold. Tears streamed down Luoji's face at the sight of this brave new world, and the sensation of newborn life permeated his every cell. The past really was a dream. When he saw the European man in the reception room, Luoji got the feeling that there was something different about him. Later, he realized that it was because the formal suit he wore didn't flash or display any image, but resembled the clothing of a bygone era. Perhaps this was an expression of solemnity. After Luoji shook the visitor's hand, he introduced himself.
"I'm Special Commissioner Ben Jonathan from the Solar Fleet Joint Conference. I arranged your reawakening at the committee's behest, and now we're going to attend the final hearing of the Wallfacer Project. Oh, can you understand me? English has changed quite a bit."
Luoji could understand what Jonathan said, but listening to him speak, the sense of Western cultural invasion that Luoji had felt over the past few days because of the changes to modern Chinese disappeared, because Jonathan's English was peppered with Chinese vocabulary. He said Wallfacer Project in Chinese, for example. English, formerly the most widely used language, and Chinese, spoken by the largest population, had blended with each other without distinction to become the world's most powerful language. Luoji learned later that the other languages of the world were undergoing the same fusion. The past isn't a dream, Luoji thought. The past catches up with you. Then he recalled that Jonathan had said the word final, and wondered if there was hope of a quick resolution after all. Jonathan looked back, as if to make sure the door had been closed, and then walked over to the wall and activated an interface. He gave a few simple taps on the surface, and then all four walls and the ceiling disappeared into a holographic display. Now Luoji found himself in an auditorium. Although everything was greatly changed, and the walls and table glowed softly, the designers had clearly tried to replicate the style of the old era. Everything from the great circular table and the rostrum to the overall layout embodied a nostalgia that allowed him to know at once where he was. The auditorium was empty, but for two staffers laying out documents on the tables. Luoji was astonished to see that paper documents were still being used. Just like Jonathan's clothes, this seemed to be an expression of solemnity.
"Remote meetings are a common practice now. Taking part in this way won't affect the meeting's importance or seriousness, Jonathan said. There's still some time before the hearing begins, and you look like you don't know much about the outside world. Do you need me to tell you a bit about the basics? Luoji nodded. Of course. Thank you. Jonathan pointed to the auditorium and said, I'll be brief. First, the countries. Europe is a single country, called the European Commonwealth, and it includes both Eastern and Western Europe, but not Russia. Russia and Belarus unified into a country still called the Russian Federation. Canada's French-speaking and English-speaking areas split into two countries. There have been some changes in other regions, too, but these are the major ones. Luoji was shocked. Those are the only changes? It's been nearly 2 centuries. I'd have thought the changes would have made the world unrecognizable. Jonathan turned back from the auditorium and nodded solemnly at Luoji. Unrecognizable, Dr. Luo. The world is indeed unrecognizable. No, there were early signs of those changes in our era. But there's one thing you never anticipated. There are no longer any great powers. All countries have declined in political power. All the countries? Then who rose up? A suprastate entity. The Space Fleet. Luoji thought this over for a while, before realizing what Jonathan meant. You mean the Space Fleet is independent? Yes. The fleets do not belong to any country. They form independent political and economic entities that, like countries, are members of the UN. Right now, there are 3 major fleets in the solar system: the Asian Fleet, the European Fleet, and the North American Fleet. Their names refer only to their primary region of origin, but the fleets themselves are no longer subordinate to those regions. They are entirely independent. Each one possesses the political and economic might of a superpower of your era. My God! Luoji exclaimed. But please don't misunderstand. Earth is not ruled by a military government. The territory and sovereignty of the space fleets is in space, and they rarely interfere with the internal affairs of terrestrial society. This is stipulated by the UN Charter. So right now, the human world is divided into 2 international spheres, the traditional Earth International and the newly emerged Fleet International. The 3 fleets of Fleet International, the Asian, European, and North American, make up the Solar Fleet, and the former Planetary Defense Council evolved into the Solar Fleet Joint Conference, nominally the highest command body in the Solar Fleet. However, as with the UN, it has a coordinating function, but no real power. In fact, it's a solar fleet in name only. The actual power of humanity's space-based armed forces lies in the hands of the supreme command of the 3 major fleets. Well then, you now know enough to take part in today's hearing. It was convened by the SFJC, which inherited the Wallfacer project. Then a window opened up on the holographic display, and an image of Bill Hines and Keiko Yamasuki appeared in it. They looked unchanged. Hines greeted Luoji with a smile, but Yamasuki sat impassively next to him, giving only a slight nod of acknowledgement at Luoji's greeting. Hines said, I just woke up, Dr. Luo. I was quite sorry to learn that the planet you cursed is still orbiting its star 50 light-years away. Heh. A joke. An ancient joke, Luoji said self-mockingly, with a wave of his hand. But compared to Tyler and Ray Diaz, you're pretty lucky. You appear to be the only successful Wallfacer. Perhaps your strategy really has elevated human intelligence. Hines displayed the same self-mocking smile that Luoji had just exhibited, and he shook his head. No, it really hasn't. I know now that after we entered hibernation, research into the human mind quickly encountered an insurmountable obstacle. Going forward meant approaching the quantum level of the brain's thought mechanisms. But at that point,
like all other science, they hit the impassable Sophon barrier. We didn't elevate human intelligence. If I did anything at all, it was just to increase some people's confidence. When Luoji entered hibernation, the mental seal had not yet been developed, so he didn't really understand the last thing Hines said. But he noticed that when he said it, a mysterious smile flashed across Keiko Yamasuki's frosty face. The window vanished, and then Luoji realized that the auditorium was full of people. Most of them were dressed in military uniforms, whose styles hadn't changed all that much. None of the attendees had pictures decorating their clothing, but their lapel pins and epaulets all glowed. The SFJC still used a rotating chair system. It was currently held by a civilian officer. As Luoji looked at him, he was reminded of Garanin. The thought struck him that he was an ancient man from 2 centuries ago, but he was at least fortunate compared to those of his own age who had been annihilated by the river of time. Once the meeting opened, the chair spoke.
"Representatives, at this hearing, we will hold the final vote on Proposition 649, put forth by the North American Fleet and the European Fleet at the 47th Joint Conference this year. First, let me read the proposition. In the second year of the Trisolar Crisis, the UN's Planetary Defense Council established the Wallfacer Project. It was adopted unanimously by the permanent members of the UN and was implemented the following year. At its core, the Wallfacer Project attempted to develop hidden strategies for resisting the Trisolaran invasion by tasking 4 Wallfacers nominated by permanent member states with formulating and executing strategic plans in the seclusion of their own minds, out of reach of the Sophon's omnipresent surveillance. The UN promulgated the Wallfacer Act to guarantee privileges to the Wallfacers for formulating and executing their plans. The Wallfacer Project has been going on for 205 years to date, a time frame that has included more than a century's hiatus. During this time, leadership of the project passed from the former PDC to the present SFJC. The Wallfacer Project arose out of a unique historical background. The Trisolar Crisis had just begun, and in the face of a devastating crisis unheard of in human history, the international community had descended to unprecedented levels of fear and despair. This was the climate into which the Wallfacer Project was born. It was not a rational choice, but a struggle of desperation. The facts of history have proven that, as a strategic plan, the Wallfacer Project was a complete and utter failure. It is no exaggeration to say that it was the most naive and foolish action that human society as a whole has ever taken. The Wallfacers were granted unprecedented power without any legal oversight, and even possessed the freedom to deceive the international community. This violated the basic moral and legal norms of human society. During the execution of the Wallfacer Project, enormous quantities of strategic resources were exhausted for no reason. Wallfacer Frederick Tyler's mosquito swarm was proven to have no strategic significance, while Wallfacer Manuel Ray Diaz's mercury chain reaction plan was unrealizable, even given humanity's present capabilities. Moreover, both of those plans were criminal. Tyler sought to attack and wipe out Earth's fleet, while Ray Diaz's even more sinister goal was to hold every life on the planet hostage. The other 2 Wallfacers were similarly disappointing. The true strategic intent of Wallfacer Hines's mental upgrade plan has not yet been revealed, but the use in the Space Forces of its preliminary result, the mental seal, is also a crime. It is a serious violation of freedom of thought, which is the foundation of the survival and further progress of human civilization. As for Wallfacer Luoji, he first irresponsibly squandered public funds on his own hedonistic lifestyle,
and then played to the crowds with ridiculous mysticism. We believe that given the decisive growth in humanity's strength and its seizure of the initiative in the war, the Wallfacer Project no longer has any meaning. The time has come to bring the problem that history has passed down to us to an end. We propose that the SFJC immediately terminate the Wallfacer Project and abolish the UN Wallfacer Act. Here ends the proposition. The chair slowly set down the proposal document and, glancing around the auditorium, said, "We will commence the vote on SFJC Proposition 649. All in favor?" All of the representatives raised their hands. Voting in this era was still done by primitive methods. Staffers walked through the auditorium solemnly verifying the number of votes, and when they reported the result to the chair, he announced, "Proposition 649 has passed unanimously and is effective immediately." The chair raised his head. Luoji didn't know whether he was looking at Hines or himself, because, like at the first remote hearing he had attended 185 years before, he still didn't know where in the auditorium his and Hines's images were displayed. "Now that the Wallfacer Project is terminated, the Wallfacer Act is abolished as well. On behalf of the SFJC, I hereby notify Wallfacers Bill Hines and Luoji that your Wallfacer status has been revoked. All associated rights granted you by the Wallfacer Act, as well as the corresponding legal immunity, are no longer in effect. You have recovered your identity as ordinary citizens of your respective countries." The chair declared the hearing adjourned. Jonathan stood up and switched off the holographic image, switching off Luoji's two-century-long nightmare in the process. "Dr. Luo, as far as I am aware, this is the outcome you were hoping for," Jonathan said to him with a smile. "Yes, it's just what I wanted. Thank you, Mr. Commissioner. And I thank the SFJC for restoring my ordinary status," Luoji said, from the depths of his heart. The hearing was simple. Just a vote on a proposition. I've been empowered to discuss matters with you in more detail. You may start with your biggest concern. "What about my wife and child?" Luoji asked, unable to hold back the question that had been tormenting him since reawakening. It was a question he had wanted to ask when he first met Jonathan, before the start of the meeting. "Don't worry. They're both fine. They're still in hibernation. I can give you their files, and you can apply to reawaken them whenever you'd like."
"Thank you. Thank you."
Luoji's eyes grew moist, and once again, he had that feeling of arriving in heaven. "However, Dr. Luo, I have a small piece of advice," Jonathan said as he slid closer to Luoji on the couch. "It's not easy for a hibernator to get used to life in this age. I advise you to stabilize your own life first, before you wake them up. The UN funds are enough to keep them in hibernation for another 230 years.
"Well, how am I supposed to live out there?"
The commissioner laughed off his question.
"Don't worry about that. You might not be used to the times, but living won't be an issue. In this age, social welfare is excellent, and a person can enjoy a comfortable life even if they don't do anything at all. The university you used to work at is still there, right in this city. They said they would consider the question of your work, and they'll contact you later on."
A thought suddenly occurred to Luoji, and it nearly made him shudder.
"What about my security when I go out? The ETO wants to kill me."
"The ETO?" Jonathan burst into laughter. "The Earth Tri-Solaris Organization was completely wiped out a century ago. There's no social foundation for them to exist in the world anymore. Of course, there are still people who have those ideological tendencies, but they aren't able to organize. You'll be absolutely safe outside." As he was about to leave, Jonathan dropped his official attitude, and his suit started shining with an exaggerated,
distorted image of the sky. He smiled and said to Luoji,
Doctor, out of all the historical figures I've seen, you've got the greatest sense of humor. A spell. A spell on a star.
Luoji stood alone in the reception room, ruminating in silence over the reality before him. After 2 centuries as a messiah, he was once again an ordinary person. A new life was waiting before him.
You're a commoner, my boy!
A gruff voice loudly intruded on Luoji's thoughts. When he looked back toward the door, he saw Shi Qiang coming in.
Heh! I heard it from the guy who just left.
It was a happy reunion. They traded experiences, and Luoji learned that Shi Qiang had reawakened 2 months before. His leukemia had been cured. The doctors had also discovered that he was at high risk of liver disease, probably due to drinking, so they had taken care of that, too. To the two of them, it didn't really feel like they had been apart for very long. No more than 4 or 5 years, since there was no sense of time in hibernation. But meeting in a new era 2 centuries in the future added a deeper level to their friendship.
I've come to pick you up when you're discharged. There's no reason to stay here,
Shi Qiang said as he took a set of clothes out of his backpack and had Luoji put them on.
Isn't it a little big?
Luoji asked, opening up the jacket.
Look at you! 2 months late waking up, and you're a yahoo next to me. Try it on.
Shi Qiang pointed out an object on the front of the shirt and told him that he could use it to adjust the sizing. When Luoji put on the clothes, he heard a hissing sound, and the clothing slowly shrank to fit the dimensions of his body. It was the same with the trousers.
Hey, you're not wearing that same set of clothes you wore 2 centuries ago, are you?
Luoji asked, looking at Shi Qiang. He remembered quite clearly that the leather jacket Shi Qiang was wearing now was the same one he had on the last time he saw him.
Most of my belongings got lost in the Great Ravine, but my family did keep that set of clothes for me. But it wasn't wearable. You've got some things left over from that era, too, and when you're settled down, you can go pick them up. I tell you, my boy, when you see how that stuff has changed, that's when you'll really know that nearly 200 years isn't a short length of time.
As he spoke, Shi Qiang pressed something somewhere on his jacket, and his outfit turned entirely white. The leather texture had just been an image.
I like it like the past.
Can mine do that too? Can it put up images like theirs?
Luoji asked, looking at his own clothes.
They can, but it's a little hard to get it set up. Let's go.
Luoji and Shi Qiang took the elevator in the trunk down to the ground floor, passed through the tree's large foyer, and out into the new world. When the commissioner shut off the holographic image of the hearing, the meeting had not actually concluded. Luoji had in fact noticed that when the chair declared the meeting adjourned, a sudden voice had rung out. It was a woman's voice, and while he hadn't been able to make it out clearly, everyone in the assembly had turned in a particular direction. Then Jonathan had turned off the image. He must have noticed it too, but once the chair had adjourned the meeting, Luoji, now an ordinary citizen without wallfacer status, was not eligible to participate, even if it was still in progress. The speaker was Keiko Yamasuki. She said,
Mr. Chair, I have something to say.
The chair said,
Dr. Yamasuki, you are not a wallfacer. You are allowed to attend today's meeting due to your special status, but you do not have the right to speak.
None of the representatives seemed interested in her. They were getting up to leave. For them, the entire wallfacer project was nothing but a footnote in history that they had to spend energy dealing with. But what she said next stopped them in their tracks. She turned to Heinz and said,
Wallfacer Bill Hines. I am your wall breaker.
Hines, who was getting up to leave, felt his legs buckle at Yamasuki's words, and he sat down in his chair again. The people in the auditorium glanced at each other, and then began to whisper, as the blood gradually drained from Hines's face.
I hope you have not all forgotten the significance of that title,
Yamasuki said imperiously to the assembly. The chair said,
Yes, we know what a wallbreaker is, but your organization does not exist anymore.
I know.
She appeared totally calm.
But as the last member of the ETO, I will fulfill my duty for the Lord.
I should have known it, Keiko. I should have known,
Hines said, his voice trembling. He looked weak. He had known that his wife was a devotee of the ideas of Timothy Leary, and he had seen her fanatical desire to alter the human mind through technological means, but he had never connected it with a deeply hidden hatred of humanity.
First off, I'd like to say that the true goal of your strategic plan was not the elevation of human intelligence. You more than anyone are aware that it is utterly impossible for human technology to accomplish this in the foreseeable future, because you were the one who discovered the quantum structure of the brain. You know that when the study of the mind reaches the quantum level, the Sofon lockdown on fundamental physics means that scientific research will be like water with no source. It's got no grounding, and will never succeed. The Mentor Seal was not just a chance byproduct of your study of the mind. It was the thing you always wanted. That was the ultimate goal of your research.
She turned to the assembly.
Now, what I'd like to know from all of you is this. In the years that we've been in hibernation, what happened to the Mentor Seal?
It didn't have much of a history, the representative of the European fleet said. Nearly 50,000 people from National Space Forces voluntarily accepted faith in victory through the Mentor Seal, and they formed a special class in the military known as the Imprinted. Later on, about 10 years after you went into hibernation, the use of the Mentor Seal was found by the International Court of Justice to be a crime, an infringement on the freedom of thought, and the sole Mentor Seal device, the one in the Faith Center, was put into storage. The manufacture and use of that type of equipment was placed under a worldwide ban nearly as strict as nuclear non-proliferation, and, in fact, the Mentor Seal was even harder to obtain than nuclear weapons, primarily because of the computer it used. By the time you entered hibernation, computing technology had basically stopped moving forward. The computer used by the Mentor Seal is still a supercomputer today, and is inaccessible to ordinary individuals and organizations. Then Keiko Yamasuki revealed her first piece of substantive information.
What you don't know is that there was more than one Mentor Seal device. 5 were made, each with its own accompanying supercomputer. The other 4, Hines secretly handed over to people who had already accepted the seal, the ones you call the Imprinted. There were only around 3,000 of them at that time, but they had already formed a tightly knit supranational organization within the militaries of individual countries. Hines did not tell me this. I learned it from the Sofons. The Lord does not care about staunch triumphalism, so we didn't take action.
And how is this significant? The chair asked.
Let's hypothesize, shall we? The Mentor Seal device is not a continuously operating piece of equipment. It's only activated when necessary. Each device can be used for quite a long time, and if they are properly maintained, it would be no problem for them to be used for half a century. If the 4 devices were used in turn, one run into the ground before the next one is started up, they would have been able to last for 2 centuries, which means that the Imprinted may not have died off, but might have endured from generation to generation up to the present day. It's a religion that believes in faith hardened by the mentor seal, and its induction ceremony is the voluntary use of the mentor seal on your own mind.
The representative of the North American fleet said,
Dr. Hines, you have lost your wallfacer status and no longer have the legal power to deceive the world. Would you please tell the Joint Conference the truth? Is your wife, or rather, your wall-breaker, telling the truth?
It's true, Hines said, with a heavy nod.
That's a crime,
the representative of the Asian fleet said.
Perhaps it is, Hines said, and nodded again. But just like all of you, I don't know whether the imprinted have endured to the present day.
That's not important,
the representative of the European fleet said.
I think the next step should be to find the mental seal devices that are still around and seal them up or destroy them. As for the imprinted, if they voluntarily accepted the mental seal, then that doesn't appear to have violated the laws of the time. If they applied the mental seal to other volunteers, then they were under the dominance of the faith or belief that they had already received through technical means, so they should not be subjected to punishment. So the only thing we need to do is find the mental seals. The matter of the imprinted might not need to be pursued at all.
That's right. It's not a bad thing for there to be a few people in the solar fleet who have absolute faith in victory. At least, it won't cause any harm. It should remain a matter of personal privacy, and no one needs to know who they are. Although it's hard to understand why anyone would voluntarily undergo the mental seal today, because humanity's victory is so apparent, the representative of the North American fleet said.
Keiko Yamasuki smiled derisively, revealing a seldom-seen expression that conjured up for the assembly an ancient picture of moonlight reflecting off the scales of a snake in the grass.
You're being naive, she said. You're being naive,
Hines echoed his wife, and deeply bowed his head. She turned once again to her husband.
Hines, you've always hidden your thoughts from me, even before you became a wallfacer.
I was afraid you'd despise me, he said, head still down.
How many times did we look silently into each other's eyes in the bamboo grove in the quiet of the Kyoto night? From your eyes, I saw a wallfacer's loneliness, and I saw your desire to speak. How many times did you almost tell me the truth? You wanted to bury your head in my arms, put everything into words through your tears, and obtain total release. But the duty of a wallfacer prevented you. Deceit, even toward the one you loved the most, was one of your responsibilities. So I could only look into your eyes in the hope of finding some trace of your true thoughts. You don't know how many sleepless nights I spent waiting next to you as you slept soundly, waiting for you to talk in your sleep. More often, I carefully observed you, studying your every move and capturing your every look, including the years you were first in hibernation. I recalled every detail about you. Not out of longing, but because I wanted to see your true thoughts. For a very long time, I failed. I knew you wore a mask, but I knew nothing of what was below the mask. The years passed, until finally, when you had just awakened and walked through the neural network cloud to my side, and I looked into your eyes, I finally understood. I'd matured 8 years, while you were still the you of 8 years before. And so, you were exposed. From that moment, I knew the real you. A deep-rooted defeatist and a staunch escapist. Both before and after you became a wallfacer, your sole goal was to achieve an exodus of humanity. Compared to the other wallfacers, your genius lay not in strategic deception, but in concealing and disguising your true worldview. But I still didn't know
how you would achieve this goal through your research into the brain and thoughts. I was confused even when the mental seal came out, all the way up until the moment I entered hibernation, when I remembered their eyes. The eyes of those people who had been given the mental stamp. They were like yours. And all of a sudden, I understood an expression of yours that I'd never been able to read before. That's when I broke through to your real strategy. But it was too late to say anything.
The representative of the North American fleet said,
Ms. Keiko Yamasuki, I don't think there's anything unusual here. We know the history of the mental seal. In the first group of 50,000 volunteers, the procedure was carried out under the strictest of supervision.
That's right, she said. But the supervision was only absolutely effective so far as the content of the faith proposition was concerned. The mental seal itself was much harder to supervise.
But the literature indicates that the supervision of the technical details of the mental seal was very strict as well, and it underwent a large number of tests before it was put into operation, the chair said.
Yamasuki shook her head.
The mental seal is an incredibly complicated piece of equipment. Any supervision will have gaps. Specifically, one tiny minus sign out of hundreds of millions of lines of code. Even the Sophons didn't detect it.
A minus sign?
When the neural circuit model for judging a proposition to be true was discovered, Hines also discovered the model for judging a proposition to be false. That was what he needed. He concealed this discovery from everyone, including me. It wasn't difficult, because the two models were highly similar. It manifested as the direction of flow of a key signal in the neuron transmission model, and in the mathematical model of the mental seal, it was represented by a sign. Positive for true, negative for false. Working in extreme secrecy, Hines manipulated this sign in the mental seal's control software. In all five devices, the sign was negative.
A deathly silence fell over the auditorium. A silence that had manifested only once before during a PDC wall-facer hearing 2 centuries ago, when Ray Diaz had shown off the cradle on his wrist and had told the assembly that the device receiving the anti-trigger signal was nearby.
Dr. Hines, what have you done?
The chair turned toward him in anger. Hines raised his head, and everyone could see that his pallid face had returned to normal. His voice was calm and even.
I admit that I underestimated the power of humanity. The progress that you've made is truly unbelievable. I have seen it, and I believe it, and I also believe that victory in the war belongs to humanity. This faith is as steadfast as if it had been imprinted by the mental stamp. The defeatism and escapism of 2 centuries ago is truly ridiculous. However, Mr. Chair and representatives, I would like to say to the world that it is impossible to make me repent of what I have done.
You still think you shouldn't repent?
The representative of the Asian fleet demanded angrily. Hines raised his head.
It's not a question of should. It's an impossibility. I used the mental seal to imprint this proposition on myself. Everything about my wall face of plan is entirely correct.
The assembly exchanged amazed glances, and Yamasuki even turned to her husband with the same expression. Hines flashed her a small smile and nodded.
Yes, dear, if you'll permit me to call you that. Only by doing that could I obtain the spiritual strength necessary to execute the plan? Yes, right now I believe all I've done is correct. I absolutely believe it, regardless of what reality says. I used the mental seal to turn myself into my own God, and God can't repent.
In the not-too-distant future, when the Trisolaran invaders surrender to a more powerful human civilization, will you still think that?
The chair asked, with a look in his eyes that was more curious than amazed. Hines nodded earnestly.
I'll still think that I'm right. Everything about my wall-facer plan is entirely correct. Of course, in the face of the facts, I'll be put through a hell of a torture.
He turned to his wife.
Dear, you know I've already suffered that torture once, when I believed that water was toxic.
Let's come back to the present day, the representative of the North American fleet said, interrupting everyone's whispered discussions. It's just speculation that the imprinted have endured. It's been over 170 years, after all. If a class or organization with such an absolute faith in defeatism exists, why haven't there been any signs of it?
There are two possibilities, the representative of the European fleet said. One is that the mental seal vanished long ago, and this is just a false alarm.
The representative of the Asian fleet completed his thought.
But there's another possibility. The most frightening thing about the situation is the fact that there aren't any signs.
Luoji and Shi Qiang walked through the underground city, shaded by the tree-shaped structures, as streams of cars flew through the gaps in the sky above them. Because the buildings were leaves hanging in the air, the ground was wide open, and the widely spaced trunks of the giant trees meant there was no sense of streets, just a rolling plaza dotted with tree trunks. The environment was wonderful. The wide swaths of grasses, forests of actual trees, and fresh air all made it look at first glance like beautiful countryside. Pedestrians passed through in shining clothes like glowing ants. Luoji was impressed to no end by the urban design that elevated modern noise and crowdedness into the air and let the ground return to nature. Here, there was no shadow of the war, only human comforts and pleasures. Before they had gotten far, he heard a woman's gentle voice.
Is that Mr. Luoji?
He looked around and found that the voice was coming from a billboard on the grass at the side of the road. An attractive woman dressed in a uniform was looking at him from the moving image.
I am,
he said with a nod.
Hello. I am Financial Counselor 8065 of the General Banking System. Welcome to our era. I will now inform you of your current financial situation.
As she spoke, a table of data appeared beside her.
These are your financial records for Year 9 of the Crisis Era, including deposits at the Industrial and Commercial Bank of China and the China Construction Bank. There are investments in quoted securities as well, but those items may have been partially lost during the Great Ravine.
How does she know I'm here? He whispered.
Shi Qiang said, A chip's been implanted in your left arm. Don't worry. These days everyone's got one. It's like an ID card. All billboards can recognize you. Ads are all personalized now, so no matter where you go, everything on the billboards is showing just for you.
Apparently hearing Shi Qiang's words, the counselor said,
Sir, this isn't an advertisement. It's a service from the general banking system.
How much do I have on deposit?
Luoji asked. A highly complicated chart appeared next to the counselor.
This is the status of all your interest-bearing accounts since Year 9 of the Crisis Era. It's fairly complicated, but you can access it in your personal information area from now on.
Another, simpler chart popped up.
This is your current financial situation in all of the various subsystems of the general banking system.
Luoji had no concept of what those figures meant, and asked blankly,
That's... how much?
My boy, you're a rich man,
Shi Qiang said, slapping him vigorously.
I may not have as much as you, but I've still got money. Heh, 2 centuries of interest. It's a real long-term investment. Pauper to tycoon. I only regret not saving a little more.
Well,
Are you sure there's nothing wrong? Luoji asked, skeptically.
Hmm?
The big eyes of the counselor looked at Luoji quizzically. It's been more than 180 years. Wasn't there any inflation? Did the finance system really just continue on smoothly?
You're overthinking it, Shi Qiang said, taking a pack of cigarettes out of his pocket.
Luoji knew then that tobacco was still around. But when Shi Qiang took one out, he was able to puff out clouds of smoke without lighting it. The counselor replied,
There were many rounds of inflation during the Great Ravine, and the finance and credit systems came close to collapse. But according to current laws, interest on the deposits of hibernators is calculated according to a special formula that excludes the Great Ravine, and instead transfers the deposit amount over to the financial level of the post-ravine period and resumes calculating interest from there.
Wow! That's some preferential treatment! Luoji exclaimed. My boy, these are good times, Shi Qiang said, blowing out smoke.
Then, raising his still-burning cigarette, he said,
Except the cigarettes are terrible.
Mr. Luoji, this is just an opportunity for us to get acquainted. When it's convenient for you, we can discuss your personal financial arrangements and investment plan. If there's nothing else, then I'll say goodbye.
The counselor smiled and waved goodbye.
I've got one question, he said quickly.
He didn't know what to call young women in this era, and didn't want to risk making a mistake by addressing her improperly. So he simply said,
I'm not too familiar with this era, so please forgive me if my question is offensive to you.
The counselor smiled and said,
Not a problem. Our responsibility is to help you get acquainted with this era as quickly as possible.
Are you a real person or a robot? Or are you a program? The question didn't faze the counselor. She replied,
Of course I'm a real person. Could a computer handle services as complicated as this?
After the woman on the billboard disappeared, Luoji said to Shi Qiang,
Da Shi, there are some things I find hard to understand. This is an age that has invented perpetual motion and can synthesize grain, but computer technology doesn't seem to have advanced at all. Artificial intelligence can't even handle personal finance.
What perpetual motion? You mean a perpetual motion machine?
Shi Qiang said.
Yeah, it signifies unlimited energy.
Shi Qiang looked around him.
Where?
Luoji pointed up to the stream of traffic.
Those flying cars, do they consume oil or batteries?
Shi Qiang shook his head.
Neither. Earth's oil was pumped dry. Those cars can fly forever without batteries, and they'll never run out of power. They're pretty awesome. I'm thinking of getting one myself.
How can you be so unmoved by a technological miracle? Unlimited power for humanity. This is as big an event as when Pongu created the heavens and the earth. Don't you realize what a magnificent age this is?
Shi Qiang tossed aside the cigarette butt. Then, thinking better of it, reached down and retrieved it from the grass and threw it into a nearby garbage can.
I'm unmoved? You're an intellectual whose imagination has gotten away from him. The technology is something we actually had in our era.
You've got to be kidding.
I don't understand most tech, but I do know a bit about this one thing in particular, because, as it happens, I once had occasion to use a police bug that had no batteries, but never ran out of power. You know how it worked? It was powered remotely by microwaves. That's what electricity is today, although the methods are a little different from our day.
Luoji stopped and stared at Shi Qiang for a long while, then up at the flying cars in the air. He thought about the heating glass, and finally understood. It was just a wireless power supply. The power source emitted electricity in the form of microwaves or other EM radiation to form an electric field over a certain space, allowing any electrical equipment within it to draw power through an antenna or resonant coil.
Like Xie Qiang had said, even 2 centuries ago, this technology was entirely ordinary. The only reason it hadn't been commonplace was because the power loss was too great. Only a small portion of the power emitted into a space could be used, but the majority was lost. In this era, however, mature controlled fusion technology meant that energy sources had been greatly enriched, to the point that losses from wireless power supplies were acceptable.
And the synthetic grain? Can't they synthesize grain?
Luo Ji asked.
I'm not really sure about that. Grain is still grown from seed. It's just that it's grown in factories and those cultivation tank things. Crops are all genetically modified, and I've heard that wheat grows just an ear, with no stalk, and it grows pretty quickly because of the strong artificial sunlight and other things like intense growth-inducing radiation. A season of wheat and rice can be harvested in a week, so from the outside, it looks just like it's been produced on a production line.
Oh.
Luo Ji punctuated his thought with an extended sigh as the gorgeous bubbles before his eyes burst to reveal the true face of the world, and he knew that in this great new era, sophons still floated everywhere and human science was still deadlocked. Existing technology could never cross the lines set down by the sophons.
And the spacecraft that can reach 15% of light speed?
Well, that's true. When those warships mobilize, it's like a tiny sun in the sky. And they're space weapons. The day before yesterday, I saw a news report on TV about an Asian fleet exercise. A laser cannon swept a target ship as big as a carrier. Half of that iron guy evaporated like a chunk of ice, and the other half exploded like fireworks in a shower of sparkling molten steel. And there are rail guns that can fire 100 iron spheres a second, each the size of a football, at tens of kilometers per second. In a few minutes, they can flatten a mountain on Mars. So, even though there isn't any of your perpetual motion, with these technologies, humanity is more than capable of putting down the Trisolaran fleet.
Xie Qiang handed Luo Ji a cigarette and taught him how to twist the filter tip to light it. They smoked and watched the snow-white swirls drift upward.
Anyway, my boy, these are good times.
Yes, good times.
Luo Ji had hardly finished speaking when Xie Qiang pounced on him, and the two of them tumbled onto the grass a few meters away, hearing a loud noise at their heels as a flying car smashed into the spot where they had just been standing. Luo Ji felt the impact of the blast, and metal debris whizzed overhead, taking out half the billboard and sending the transparent glass tubes of the display crashing to the ground. While he was still on the ground with a dizzy head and a black eye, Xie Qiang leapt up and ran over to the flying car. Its disc-shaped body was entirely broken and deformed, but due to the lack of onboard fuel, it hadn't caught fire. There was only the sound of sparks crackling in the twisted metal.
There's no one in the car,
Xie Qiang said to Luo Ji, who was limping over.
Da Shi, you saved my life again,
Luo Ji said, leaning on his shoulder and massaging his injured leg.
I don't know how many times I'll have to. You really ought to grow some sense. And a few more eyes.
He pointed to the totaled flying car.
Remind you of anything?
Luo Ji thought about that occasion 2 centuries before and shivered involuntarily. Lots of pedestrians crowded round, the scenes of terror on their clothing flashed as one. 2 police cars landed, sirens blaring, and several officers got out to form a line around the broken car. Their uniforms flashed like the police light, drowning out the crowd's clothing with their brightness. The one officer who came over to Xie Qiang and Luo Ji had clothing so bright they had to shut their eyes.
You were right here when the car fell. You aren't hurt, are you?
He said with concern. He evidently could see that the two of them were hibernators, because he made an effort to speak
ancient Chinese. Before Luoji could answer, Xie Qiang pulled the officer who had asked the question across the tape and out of the crowd. Once they had gotten away, the officer's uniform stopped flashing.
"You need to check up on this. It might be an assassination attempt," he said.
The officer laughed. "Really? It's just a traffic accident."
"We want to report it."
"Are you sure?"
"Of course. We're reporting it."
"You're making a big deal out of it. You may have been startled, but it really was a traffic accident. However, according to the law, if you insist on reporting it..."
"We insist."
The officer pressed a display area on his sleeve. It popped up an information window, which he looked over and then said, "It's been reported. For the next 48 hours, the police will track you. But this requires your agreement."
"We agree. We might still be in danger."
The officer laughed again.
"It's really a common occurrence." "A common occurrence? Let me ask you. On average, how many traffic accidents of this kind take place in this city every month?"
"There were 6 or 7 all of last year."
"I'll have you know, officer, in our time, this city had more than that every day.
Cars all ran on the ground in your day. I can't even imagine how dangerous that was. Well, you're now in the police surveillance system. You'll be notified of any progress on your case. But please believe me, this is an ordinary traffic accident. Whether or not you filed a report, you would still receive compensation." After they left the police and the scene of the accident behind, Xie Qiang said to Luoji,
"We'd better get back to my place. I don't feel at ease when I'm outside. It's not far. We probably should walk back. Taxis are unmanned, so it's not safe."
"But hasn't the ETO been destroyed?" Luoji asked, looking about him. Off in the distance, the fallen car had been lifted up by a larger flying car. The crowd had dispersed, and the police car had left. A municipal works vehicle had landed, and several workmen had gotten out to gather scattered debris and begin repairs to the ground, which had been damaged by the crash. Following the small commotion, the city had returned to its normal, pleasing calm.
"Perhaps it has, but you've got to trust my intuition, my boy."
"I'm no longer a wall facer."
"That car didn't seem to think so. While we're walking, pay attention to the cars above you."
They kept to the shade of the tree-like buildings as much as possible, and crossed any open spaces they reached at a run. Soon they arrived at a broad plaza, and Xie Qiang said,
"My place is just opposite. It's too far to go around, so we'll have to make a run for it."
"Isn't that being a little paranoid? Maybe it was just a traffic accident."
"That's a maybe, though. There's nothing wrong with being careful. See that sculpture in the center of the plaza? If anything happens, we can hide there."
There was a square sandy area in the center of the plaza, like a miniature desert. The sculpture that Xie Qiang mentioned, located right in the center of the sand, was a group of black pillar-like objects, each 2 or 3 meters tall. From a distance, it looked like a grove of withered black trees. Luoji ran across the plaza behind Xie Qiang. When they neared the sandy area, he heard Xie Qiang call,
"Hurry! Get in there!"
And he was dragged skidding across the sand, and then headlong into the withered grove. Lying on the grove's warm sand, he looked up between the black pillars at the sky and saw a flying car zoom down and buzz the grove before pulling up and accelerating away. The gust of wind it left in its wake blew a burst of sand into the air, which hit the pillars with a whoosh.
"Maybe it wasn't headed for us."
Maybe,
Xie Qiang said, and he sat up and dumped the sand out of his shoes.
"Will they laugh at us for this?" "Don't be afraid of that crap. Who's going to recognize you? Besides, we're from 2 centuries ago, so even if we're entirely normal, people are still gonna laugh. My boy, nothing's lost by being careful.
What if the thing really was headed for you?
Only then did Luoji turn his attention to the sculpture they were inside. He noticed that the pillars weren't withered trees, but arms extending out of the desert. The skinny arms were just skin and bones, so at first glance, they looked like dead tree trunks. The hands atop them made a variety of distorted gestures to the sky, and seemed to express a kind of endless pain.
What kind of sculpture is this?
Within this group of struggling arms, Luoji felt a chill, even though he was still sweating from the run. At the sculpture's edge, he saw a solemn obelisk, on which was carved a line of large golden characters. Make time for civilization, for civilization won't make time.
The Great Ravine Memorial, Xie Qiang said.
He did not seem interested in explaining further, but led Luoji out of the sculpture and across the other half of the plaza at a fast clip.
Okay, my boy. This tree's where I live, Xie Qiang said, pointing to the massive architectural tree in front of them.
Luoji looked around him as he walked. All of a sudden, he heard the floor creak, and then the ground fell away under his feet, and he plummeted downward. Xie Qiang grabbed hold of him when his chest was already at ground level, and struggled to haul him up. After he had his footing, the two of them stared at the hole in the ground. It was the mouth of a sewer, and its cover had slid aside just as Luoji was about to step on it.
My God, are you all right, sir? That's really dangerous, said a voice issuing from a small billboard next to them.
The billboard was attached to a small pavilion containing a machine selling drinks and such, and the speaker was a young man dressed in a blue uniform. His face was pale, and he seemed even more frightened than Luoji.
I'm with the Office of Excavation and Drainage at the Third Municipal Administration Company. That cover opened automatically. It might be a software failure.
Does this happen often? Xie Qiang asked.
Oh, no, no. At least, this is the first time I've ever seen it.
Xie Qiang picked up a small round stone from the grass next to the road and tossed it down the hole. It was quite some time before they heard any sound.
Damn! How deep is it?
He asked the man in the billboard.
Around 30 meters. So, like I said, it's really dangerous. I've inspected the surface drainage system. The sewers in your day were all pretty shallow. This accident has been recorded. You...
He glanced at his sleeve as he spoke.
Ah, Mr. Luo, you can go to the TMAC to be compensated.
At last, they reached the lobby leading to Xie Qiang's tree, number 1863. He said that he lived on branch 106, near the top, and advised Luoji to eat down below before going up. They went into a restaurant on one side of the lobby. Aside from being as clean as a 3D rendering, one characteristic of this age was even more obvious here than when he first saw it in the Reawakening Center. Dynamic information windows were everywhere, on the walls, tabletops, chairs, the floor and ceiling, and even on small objects like the glasses and napkin holders on the table. Everything had an interface and display with scrolling text or moving images. It was as if the entire restaurant was a giant computer display, showing off a diverse and glittering splendor. Not many people were dining. They chose a table by the window and sat down. Xie Qiang tapped the tabletop to activate an interface and then ordered a few dishes.
I can't read the foreign writing, so I've only ordered Chinese ones.
The world seems like it's built using bricks made from displays, Luoji sighed.
That's right. Anything smooth can light up.
As Xie Qiang spoke, he took out a pack of cigarettes and passed it to Luoji.
Look at this. Just a pack of cheap cigarettes.
As soon as Luoji held the pack in his hands, it started displaying an animated image of several miniature pictures that seemed like an options menu.
It's just a film that can display images, Luoji said as he looked at the pack. A film? You can go online with this gadget.
Xu Qiang reached over and tapped the pack, and one of the miniature pictures sank in like a button. Then the advertisement he selected took over the entire pack. In the picture, Luoji saw a family with one child sitting in a living room. The picture obviously came from the past, and a shrill voice sounded from the pack.
Mr. Luo, this is the era you used to live in. We know that in that age, owning a house in the capital was the grand dream of every person. Now, the Greenleaf Group can help you achieve that dream. As you can see, this is a wonderful age. Houses have turned into leaves on a tree, and the Greenleaf Group can provide you with every kind of leaf.
Here the picture showed a scene of leaves being added to a tree branch, and then a dazzling variety of hanging homes, one of which was even completely transparent, with furnishings inside that seemed suspended in midair.
Of course, we can also build you a traditional home on the surface to return you to the warmth of the Golden Age, and build you a warm family.
A lawn and detached home, perhaps another old photo, appeared on screen. The voice artist in the ad spoke in fluent, ancient Chinese, but paused momentarily before the word family, then said it with particular emphasis. After all, it was something the speaker didn't have, something that belonged to the past. Xu Qiang took the cigarette pack out of Luoji's hands, withdrew the last two cigarettes, passed one to him, and then crumpled the empty pack into a ball and tossed it onto the table. On the crumpled ball, the images still flashed, but the sound had disappeared.
Whenever I go anywhere, the first thing I do is to turn off every screen that's around me. They're so annoying, Xu Qiang said, turning off the tabletop and floor displays with his hands and feet. But the people here can't be away from them. He pointed around them. There aren't any computers anymore. Anyone who wants to go online or something can just tap any smooth surface. Clothing and shoes can be used as computers, too. Believe it or not, I've even seen toilet paper that you can go online with.
Luoji pulled out a napkin. It was just ordinary, non-wired paper, but the paper box activated, and the pretty woman on it hawked bandages to Luoji, evidently aware of today's experiences and guessing that his arms and legs might have gotten scraped up.
God,
Luoji sighed, and stuffed the napkin back in the box.
This is the information age. Our times were pretty damn primitive,
Xu Qiang said with a laugh. While they waited for their food, Luoji asked Xu Qiang about his life. He felt a little guilty for only asking now, but looking back on how the day had gone, he had been something of a clockwork machine ticking relentlessly forward. Only now did he have a bit of free time.
They had me retire. It's not a bad deal, Xu Qiang said simply.
Was it the Public Security Bureau, or the unit you were at later? Are they still around?
They're around, and the PSB is still the PSB. But even before hibernation, I wasn't connected to it anymore. The unit I was with later now belongs to the Asian Fleet. You know, the fleet is like a big country, so I'm a foreigner now.
Saying this, he exhaled a long cloud of smoke. He watched the cloud ascend, as if he was trying hard to unravel a mystery.
Countries don't have the significance they used to. The world's changed. It's confusing.
Fortunately, Da Shi, you and I are the kind of indifferent people who can live, and live well, no matter what happens.
Luo, my boy, to tell you the truth, I'm not as open-minded as you in certain things. I'm not as uninvolved. If I'd been through everything you have, I'd have fallen apart long ago.
Luoji picked up the crumpled cigarette pack from the table, opening it to reveal the image that was still showing, with only a little discoloration. It was playing the Greenleaf Group advert. He said, "Whether as messiah or as refugee, I can always use what resources I have to try and live a happy life. You might think I'm selfish, but to be honest, this is the only thing I respect about myself."
Da Shi, let me say something about you.
You look like a careless person. But deep in your bones, you're someone who prizes responsibility. Leave that responsibility completely behind now. Look at this age. Who needs us? Carpe diem is our most sacred duty.
Sure. But if I gave up all responsibility, you wouldn't have much of an appetite at all right now.
Xu Qiang tossed his cigarette into the ashtray, activating a cigarette advert. Luoji realized he had misspoken.
Oh, no, Da Shi.